to do two things. One, if you're not already, become a member of the Vancouver Institute, which is a $25 family fee, $15 for single and $5 for student. And also, if you would give some thought to making a donation to the Vancouver Institute. We have a very slim budget, and what we do spend, much of it goes on advertising, which gets, of course, the word of our programs to more people. So outside you'll find these blue program brochures, and they also contain information about becoming a member and, of course, making donations. This evening we're very pleased to welcome Professor Cal Holstey of the University of British Columbia. He was born in Geneva of Finnish parents and received his BA, MA, and PhD at Stanford University. He has been visiting professor at the University of Japan, at McGill, Kyoto, and the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He has been also a research fellow of Pacific Studies at the Australian National University. He was a board member of the Canadian Institute for International Peace and Security between 1987 and 1990. He received the Killam Research Prize in 1992 and was made Killam Professor at UBC in 1997. He is the former president of the International and Canadian Political Science Association. His latest of many books, The State, War, and The State of War, is published by Cambridge University Press. Professor Holstey's principal research interests lie in the areas of the relationship between developed and undeveloped nations, international relations, and strategic theory. His subject tonight is War in the 20th Century. Can we do better in the 21st? Please welcome Professor Cal Holstey.
Thank you very much from the Record Man on 4th Avenue. It was a pleasure. Talks of this kind usually begin with some kind of a humorous anecdote, but the subject of the discussion tonight doesn't really lend itself too much to humor. When people start talking about war, they usually are in agony of some kind, or wringing their hands, or perhaps angry, and quite frequently in this day, somewhat cynical. This point was brought home to me several days ago when one of my colleagues, when he saw the title of this talk, Can We Do Better in the 21st Century, suggested that perhaps I had orchestrated the most recent crisis in Iraq so that the bombs would start falling and I could come tonight and give you a definitive answer of no, and then we could all go home. I want to talk about war, not too much in the prophetic sense, but about a trend that has become very marked since 1945. In fact, two different trends going in somewhat the opposite direction. It is typically a story of good news and of bad news as well. In 1989, an American political scientist by the name of John Mueller published a book called Retreat from Doomsday, The Obsolescence of Major War. A very influential book, and he argued that war is a human institution which is learned, it's a cultural artifact, and like slavery and dueling, we can do away with it, just as we have with those institutions. It made a big impact because the book was actually written in about 1987, before the end of the Cold War, and many people thought that he was quite prescient in making his predictions. But I think we have to remember that at another time when the world seemed to be in fairly good state, around the turn of the century, several other books of this genre were published. One in 1906 by a Frenchman by the name of Marc Bloch, who argued that because of the application of technology to the art of war, war had become so horrible in its lethal consequences that we could not anticipate educated, liberal civilizations going to war anymore. And an even more influential book written by Norman Angell called The Great Illusion in 1910. He argued that because of the high degree of interdependence, economic transactions, the expansion of democracy and republicanism, war today was an anachronism. And of course, we all know that 4 years later, we were ensconced in what was then called the Great War. The turn of the century was an era of great optimism, and I think since the end of the Cold War, we have returned to that optimism, and I think Mueller's book is an indication of that. Mueller's book is well articulated and well supported with empirical evidence, and I'd like to give that some of that to you. But before I do, I should read to you a very short passage written by a retired British general in 1928 who had survived the First World War and who had thought a great deal about the problem of war in the coming era. He said, "The cautious observer who tries to deduce guidance for the future from the experiences of the past will do well to find out what the experts of the past were saying and thinking about war before it came. If he does so, he will discover that those experts have, with rare exceptions, been proven wrong." So that is the spirit of my discussion tonight. It has an optimistic ring to it to a certain extent, but I am willing to be proven wrong. 1945 was a great historical watershed, and we have the evidence to support that now, that contrary to the previous 300 years of European history, we have not had a war involving the great powers now for 53 years. That is historically unprecedented. We could say that perhaps the Korean War was a slight exception. But great power war was a constant artifact of the diplomatic landscape of 17th, 18th, 19th, and early 20th century Europe. In fact, in the 17th century, there were only 7 years in the century when one or other of the great powers was not involved somewhere at war. And the record of the first half of the 20th century is historically the worst record since the origins of the state system in the 17th century. I won't read you a lot of statistics, but I can give you the kind of figures that maybe an insurance company might consider. That in the 1930s, or even the 1920s, given the number of states in the system, the chances of any state going to war in any given year was about 1 out of 36. So you wouldn't want to bet too much on that. Since 1945, the chances of a state going to war against another state is now 1 in 225. So compared to just a little over a half century ago, we have had a rather incredible decline in the incidence of interstate war. In fact, we've only had 38 since 1945, and that number is a little bit fudged, as I'll explain in a few moments. And we have some areas of the world where there has been no direct war experience for well over a half century. There's been no war, although there have been some militarized crises in South America. There's been no war since 1941, no war in North America, or even armed intervention since 1913. And Europe since 1945, with the exception of Ireland, and if we want to include the Balkans as part of Europe, has been pretty much at peace. So we have these fairly large and extensive zones of peace where predictably we could say that conflicts between states will not eventuate in armed conflict or in arms and violence. If we think it was only back in 1937, November of 1937, that Hitler met with his generals and told them of his plans of conquest to the east and the necessity of first defeating the French before he could turn his guns and his killing squads into Poland and Soviet Union. About the same time, Mussolini was talking and had dreams of the great empire which he was going to create in the Roman image, vastly supported by the Germans. And the Japanese had their image of the greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere, which was a vision of a regional order in which Western powers would not participate, and it would be based on hierarchical principles with the Japanese predominating over the other partners in that particular enterprise. So the idea of conquest, empire, was still very much alive in the world only 60, 70 years ago, and we don't find counterparts of the same kind today. If we think that perhaps 60 or 70 years is too far to go back, it was in 1951 when Joseph Stalin called his associates from the satellite countries to Moscow and told them that they should put their economies on a war footing, because while the United States was busily engaged in Korea, it might offer an opportunity for the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact to march into Western Europe. In recent years, we've had only the Ayatollah, who has had some ideas of reconstructing the state system in a certain kind of an image. And then we have, of course, the proverbial mystery man, Saddam Hussein, but with a great difference from the Stalins and Hitlers and Maos of previous years, that these are essentially leaders without foreign followers, whereas Hitler and Mussolini had their surrogates and their friends all over the world, including North America. This is not the case of these latter-day potential empire builders. So we've had this very great historical change of no great power wars, and we have to account for it, and various people have done this in various ways. There, the optimists provide a variety of explanations. One is purely technological. They would argue that nuclear weapons have rendered war so horrible to contemplate, a war in which there would not conceivably be any victors in the traditional sense of the term. And this has rendered the calculation of war making entirely new. But on the other hand, we have to recognize that the vast majority of the states in the world do not have nuclear weapons, and so this explanation would not hold. Another popular explanation is that the intertwining of the economies of the world, what we call economic interdependence, makes war, again, a irrational act type of activity, where the costs would always outweigh any possible gains. But remember that Norman Angell in 1910 was making exactly the same argument, and nevertheless, the world went to war 4 years later. Another kind of argument is that, true to the predictions that Immanuel Kant, the famous Prussian philosopher of the late 18th century, argued, that as the world became more democratic, republics would not go to war against each other. And one of the empirical findings of political scientists in the last decade or so has been that this particular prediction has come true. That going back to 1815, or at least the middle of the 19th century, one of the few generalizations we could make about war is that there have not been, with a few very minor exceptions, any wars between two democratic states. And it figures, therefore, that as you get more democracies in the world, the probabilities of their going to war against each other have diminished very significantly. Now, this is an interesting argument, but on the other hand, we have to recognize that world depressions and the fragility of certain new democracies does not give one entirely great amount of confidence in this as a necessary scenario for the future, and as a totally adequate explanation for this very fundamental change we have seen since 1945. Another argument is that the lessons, and this incidentally draws also upon the predictions of Immanuel Kant, was that the horrors of the First World War and the Second World War have, in a sense, debellicized Western societies and perhaps other areas of the world as well. That societies have become increasingly sensitive to the problem of casualties, whether civilian or military, and that governments are no longer willing, because their populations are no longer willing, to accept casualty rates caused by wars of no great potential benefit to their fighters. We could point out, for example, that when the United States intervened militarily into Lebanon the last time in the 1970s, it took one explosion organized by the resistance there, which killed 238 Marines, and the American troops came home very shortly thereafter. The United States humanitarian intervention, along with many other countries in Somalia, led to some casualties. In one particular incident, 12 military personnel of the United States were killed by civilians in Somalia, and once again, the American military mission ended very shortly after. And it is the case now that in the United States that in the contemplation of any military activity, they have written for themselves a series of very strict rules and conditions under which any military activity will be undertaken. And if those conditions are not met, presumably they will not take on those particular missions. And finally, I think I could mention, thanks in part to work by my colleagues, that in international relations, territory has become sanctified to an extent that it never was previously. If you go back to the 18th and 19th century and even to the 20th century, the bargaining over territory, the partition of states, the swallowing up of small states was a normal part of international relations. It happened all the time. Pieces and provinces were lopped off here to give to somebody else, a war was fought, and at the end of every war there was a territorial reconfiguration of the world, as was the case after the Second World War, with the Soviet Union being the biggest territorial winner of that particular war. One finds since 1945 that the territorial dimension of international conflicts has diminished very, very significantly. Compared to previous eras, the number of territorial adjustments, either before, during, or after wars, has declined precipitously. And I think it's symbolic of this, perhaps, that in 1991, despite what some pessimists think, that the vast reaction to the physical conquest of Kuwait by Iraq in the summer of 1990, I should say, led to a very concerted effort to undo that. It's a kind of concern that was not evident in the 1930s when small states were being swallowed up, and perhaps that was the symbolic significance of the Gulf War, was to suggest that we had finally arrived in an era when the independence of states really means something and that the community is willing to put forces at the disposal of those who would like to undo those particular wrongs. All of these explanations of this rather significant historical change since 1945 are fairly optimistic, and one would be led to believe that the circumstances and the conditions in those explanations are likely to continue into the future, which would lead us then to suggest that yes, we can do better and we probably will do better. That we're not going very likely to go back to the patterns of the 1930s, and the international community will do everything it possibly can to sustain the sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of its members. After all, this is what the United Nations was created for and has now seen that it can, in fact, do something about it when it is challenged. There are more pessimistic explanations and hypotheses about the future as well that I should mention. There are a group of people whom we might call the new Malthusians, who are quite convinced that because of the population pressures of the world and the diminishing of certain kinds of resources, including water and perhaps even clean air, that we are likely to see armed conflicts in the future revolve around environmental issues as these resources of scarcity become increasingly fought over by neighboring states. Another fairly pessimistic prognosis, those who talk about the law of uneven economic development, which has been going on now for a number of centuries, whereby we see this constant parade of great powers who rise or which rise and then decline, and they cannot keep up because of various economic factors. And this immediately leads them to make projections and predictions about the case of China in the future. We have to contemplate that within our lifetimes, in the next 20 or 30 years, that China will probably have the largest economy in the world if it holds together for that long. And then, of course, immediately people begin to think, well, if China becomes a predominant economic power, is it not likely also to use that for military purposes and eventually for the domination of Asia? Well, I think I would join probably the group of optimists suggesting that the conditions that we see around the world today are really quite supportive of the notion that we're not likely to reverse the pattern of the last 45 or 53 years, where we have not seen any great power wars, although we've seen, of course, many great power armed interventions. But we do have to acknowledge the problem of accidents, anomalies, strange cases. This is never to predict that there will never be any more wars. That would be silly. But the long-range trend seems to be reasonably well established, 53 years now, that we have a significant historical change which is not likely to be reversed in the foreseeable future. In my opinion, the great question mark is Russia, a country in which, since the end of the Cold War, has been going into a tailspin, a multidimensional tailspin, where almost every single indicator of social welfare, whether life expectancy, literacy, health, law and order, is in a downward direction. And one can only speculate how long the Russian society can tolerate this particular direction, when it will begin to reverse itself, whether Russia will even hold together as a federation. Already we've seen the cracks begin in the case of Chechnya. That, of course, in my view, then, is the big question mark. And one would be, I think, probably foolish at this stage to suggest any kind of a reasonably secure prediction in that case. Well, the good news, then, is that we are on a trajectory of very significant decline in the incidence of armed weapons between great powers and other states. Probably things, kind of a trend that I suggest is probably, if not irreversible, is likely to continue and become even more strongly entrenched. Chateau UBC, 1998. Very well done. The other side of the coin is the problem of domestic wars. That as we have seen this dramatic reversal in the incidence of wars between states, we have seen accompanying it a dramatic increase in the incidence of war within countries. More than 75% of all the wars, however we define wars, have been essentially domestic conflicts. And even a fairly high proportion of the wars which eventually became interstate wars, usually by armed outside intervention of one or more of the great powers, began as domestic armed conflicts. One thinks of Vietnam or Afghanistan. This is the problem of the internationalization of domestic conflicts. By my count, we've had 164 wars up to 1995, since 1945, and only 20 of those were truly interstate wars of the old-fashioned kind. All of the remainder began as domestic conflicts, and the most of them remained domestic conflicts. A few became internationalized. So the figure is actually more around 85% of the wars we've seen since 1945 began as domestic conflicts. And we have a little difficulty dealing with these kinds of conflicts because many of their characteristics are very different from the classical interstate wars of the last 350 years. I think perhaps a better term for these is what we might call protracted social conflicts, in which violence plays a very large part. But it is a somewhat different phenomenon from classical kind of wars. And it is very much a phenomenon of the second half of the 20th century, and by my projections will continue to be a major problem in the early part of the 21st century. We have wars and have had wars in Bougainville in the South Pacific, in Burma since 1962, in Sudan since 1983, Cyprus remains divided, has been divided since 1964. The Chechnya War perhaps is not yet over. Eritrea was at war for 30 years before it finally seceded successfully from Ethiopia. We've had the mess in Rwanda, other massacres in Burundi and other countries. And if I may, I would just like to summarize some of the characteristics of these wars because they really do suggest that we're talking about a somewhat different phenomenon than wars that we often think about. One of their characteristics is their extraordinarily great length. The average of these wars, these protracted social conflicts, and protracted is a well-used, well-chosen term, is about 27 years. The average war in the 17th century or the 18th century was about 3.5 years. And one of the reasons we used terms such as the 7 years war back in from 1756 to 1763 was because it was unusually long by 18th century standards. Well, these wars we're talking about since 1945, most of them go on well over 20 years, and some of them more than 30 years. A second characteristic is that very few of these wars have been or are likely to be settled through negotiations. The vast majority have been settled by conquest, that is to say, the military defeat of one or the other of the parties involved in the conflict. Only about 15% of them have been resolved through diplomatic negotiations, and more distressingly, of those that were settled by negotiations and that ended up with this kind of a treaty, only about 1/3 of those treaties were operative 5 years later. That is to say, the parties went back to war even after they had made peace. A third characteristic, and I don't think I need to dwell on this, but the figures are truly remarkable, that of the casualties in these wars, 90%, or almost 90%, have been among civilians, with women and children being deliberately targeted as objects of military campaigns. This compares with a figure of 50% civilian casualties in the Second World War and 5% civilian casualties in World War I, and through most of the 19th century wars, virtually no civilian casualties. Another characteristic of these wars is the breakdown of what we might call the institutional aspects of war. And it may sound somewhat peculiar to you to use the term institution, which suggests regularized procedures and laws, norms, rules. But the fact is that the European war, at least, with the exception of colonial wars, was always, at least from the late 17th century, very highly institutionalized, with regulations that dealt with a whole set of issues about how you declare war, how you make peace, when it is okay to surrender after you have breached the wall in the case of a siege, how you deal with wounded soldiers, how you deal with prisoners, and all of these kinds of things. And if you look at the orders of the Prussian General Staff in the late 19th century, the two very, very thick volumes that deal with all of the rules of warfare, and the other aspects you know perfectly well from either having participated or seen in films or television, the elaborate uniforms, the very highly articulated command and control structure, the forms of decorations, essentially the clear distinction between combatants who wear distinctive garb compared to civilians who do not. And all of these things we are beginning to see disappear in most of these protracted social conflicts. And if we look at wars such as those going on in Liberia today or Sierra Leone or in Bosnia and other places more recently, we begin to see the dividing line between war and criminality being increasingly blurred, where the drug trade, gun running, the selling of national assets to buy the instruments of war, all of these now have become part of the war. We don't have professional soldiers in these wars. Frequently, we have hopped up 15-year-old, 14-year-old, 13-year-old teenagers who are paid in drugs, sometimes in money. Maybe going back a little bit to some of the patterns we found in the medieval era, when the dividing lines between war and other kinds of violence were not so clearly drawn as they were in the 18th, 19th, and early 20th century. And the depressing thing about these wars is that, and one of the reasons they go on for so long, is that the combatants, many of them, have a very strong economic stake in the continuation of the war. And I must say, in a few instances, though I wouldn't want to generalize about this, in a few cases, non-governmental organizations also have a stake in the continuation of the war, and you get a rather disastrous symbiotic relationship between criminals, warlords, government officials, and NGOs. So compared to previous centuries, these wars are, to quote our Thomas Hobbes, they are long, nasty, and brutish. Now, I want to just dwell a few minutes about why we have these kinds of wars, because they're going to be with us for a long time. At the end of the Cold War, certain American political scientists discovered what they called ethnic wars. And I recommend to you a book written by an American journalist who works on the ground by the name of Robert Kaplan, who wrote a very influential article that was published in Atlantic Monthly called The Coming Anarchy, in which he argued that the combination of population pressures and lack of resources and illegal migration between societies was going to get worse rather than better and would be a constant source of irritation and war and conflict, and that the West should accommodate itself to this fact. Others have argued that, rather myopically in my view, that the end of the Cold War brought about a situation where long festering ethnic animosities were let loose. This was a kind of view which lamented, in a sense, the end of the Cold War, because they argued that the Cold War had kept the lid on these ancient animosities between ethnic groups and various kinds of communities, particularly in the case of Eastern Europe and the Balkans. And now that the great powers were withdrawing from around the world, all of these ancient animosities were bubbling forth, and the consequence is what happened in Yugoslavia and elsewhere. Ethnicity, then, is a significant source of these wars, it has been argued. I think the analysis is fundamentally wrong, and for the following reasons. First of all, most of these conflicts that perhaps make up the headlines today but did not make up the headlines of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s started long before the end of the Cold War. But it was the myopia of political scientists and strategic thinkers, because they were so, and I should say the peace movement as well, they were so fascinated with the dynamics of the Cold War and the arms race that they did not observe what was going on in other areas of the world. Only it was when the United States or the Soviet Union was directly involved in a war, such as the Ogaden War in the late 1970s, that they paid any attention to these. And of course, if there was a communist faction involved, this became a matter of headlines. But most of these wars that we have going on today began long before the end of the Cold War. Many of them have nothing to do with ethnicity, or if ethnicity is involved, it is only one of many conditions which bring forth these kinds of conflicts. To a certain extent, these analyses and explanations of so-called ethnic wars reflect our old patterns of imperialist thought, this idea that it takes the West to tame the rest of the world, and once the West departs from the rest of the world, they will go back to their primordial violence and aggression and hatreds, and in a sense, the Cold War was a civilizing mission in some ways. The Cold War as hostile, violent, exotic, and so forth. But in fact, if we look at the record of war between states in the Third World, their record is somewhat better than the record of war in Europe throughout most of modern European history. I want to say a few words about what the sources of these conflicts are in addition to ethnicity, when ethnicity is involved, if ever. I make my comments on the basis of a study I finished last year for the United Nations University, which is a multi-authored study of the sources of humanitarian emergencies. because there's a very, very great concern in among United Nations officials, not only about where these things are going to happen, but why they are happening. My own study was based on a fairly close examination of 17 cases of these kinds of wars, and what one finds is certain common characteristics. I think the first I'd have to say is that there are certain legacies of imperialism that help to account for the conditions which are very likely to eventuate in armed conflict within these states. And we have to remember that most colonies were never created in order to become states. For many of them, their territorial boundaries were drawn in Berlin, London, Paris, Washington, and other places. And those boundaries have absolutely nothing to do with the historical patterns of living among the people involved. In many cases, old communication routes were broken. Various forms of political organizations, whether they were tribal or imperial, were broken up. People were scattered. They were divided in all sorts of arbitrary ways, basically to fulfill the needs of the colonial powers, but very detrimental to the interests of the peoples themselves. And it's quite amazing that the Great Congress of Berlin in 1985, which was called in order to put an end to the competitive conflicts going on among the imperial powers in Africa, that not a single African was invited to that Congress. So we have a problem of a kind of discontinuity between the state as it has been created out of colonies on the one hand and the societies that which inhabit those states. In almost all cases, these societies are multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-language, and somehow, upon gaining independence, they have to convert these highly heterogeneous societies into something akin to a integrated nation state. A second problem is the nature of governance in many of these societies. In many of them, the notion of civil service as a service to the society is quite foreign. In many of them, they are basically systematic looting devices, that is to say, the governments are systematic looting devices, where political leaders, based on patrimonial systems, have to extract resources from the society in order to pay for their supporters and have no intention and no capacity to bring government services which you and I pretty much take for granted in this country. The cast of characters who we might characterize as kleptocrats, that is to say, they are basically systematic predators of their own societies, would include the Marcoses, the Duvaliers, the Somozas, Mobutu, Amin, Ne Win in Burma, Suharto, and many, many others who have no conception of governance as we understand it. Of these 17 cases, what else they had in common was that in 11 of them, they were not ethnic wars as we understand it, that is to say, spontaneous uprisings of one community against another. In 11 of them, the killing started by the government itself against its own citizens. What one found in all of the cases was a pattern of systematic exclusion by government officials against designated communities within the state, sometimes ethnic communities, but not always. And the range of policies by which communities were excluded, either from access to government office or access to government services, ranged all the way from informal kinds of apartheid to disenfranchisement of a subtle sort, and then at the other extreme to genocide, to mass expulsions, and to murders on a large scale. I think we have to recognize that if we look at the 20th century as a whole, we think of it's been a bad century of war. The fact of the matter is that more people have lost their lives by the hands of their own government than have lost their lives because of invading troops from another country. In a sense, the 20th century is not so much the century of total war as it is a century of mass murder by governments against their own people. This is a fairly common phenomenon. So we're not here talking about ethnic wars as spontaneous uprisings of people who can't live with their neighbors. Quite the contrary, it is frequently the government which sets upon specific communities within the state for their own political purposes. This is what we might call playing the ethnic card, although frequently it may be a religious card or a language card or a card of many colors. Now, I don't want to suggest that this is an entirely common situation. Unfortunately, it is somewhat common, but it is not entirely common. I think we have to acknowledge that a variety of states have made a very successful transition from being very artificial colonial entities created in the image of Western states to being reasonably robust, reasonably strong states with reasonably cohesive societies. One can think of Fiji, of Hawaii, of Malaysia, of Mauritius, Singapore, and many, many others, which seem to be on a trajectory of reasonable strength, stability, and where the probabilities or even the possibilities of social protracted warfare are declining all the time. Well, looking to the next millennium then, what can we say in conclusion? The first is that the main problem of the 21st century will not be classical war between states. We will continue to have armed interventions of one kind or another, as we perhaps have had in Iraq. But the old issues which generated conflicts in the European context for 300, 350 years, the dreams of empire, the attempt to gain more territory, attempt to gain monopolistic control of resources, have pretty well gone by the board. And 1945 sort of stands as the watershed year between that kind of activity and what we've seen since then. The main problem that we'll have in the 21st century is a continuation of the last 20 or 30 years, is not a problem of these kinds of issues, it is a problem of human governance, about how communities live with each other, how they fashion a state in which you can have multiple communities, because that is the typical situation of most states today, not at all unusual, and the relations between multiple communities and their own state. We are accustomed to seeing this problem in the context of the Quebec issue in Canada, which we spend a great deal of time agonizing and worrying about. This is it's a universal phenomenon, and it pops up everywhere. We may be lucky in the sense that the probabilities of violence in our particular secession situation are probably fairly low. But it's the same kind of issues being fought today in Kosovo. We might have armed conflict there again of a major kind. And all of these other places that I've mentioned, it's a very common phenomenon. In addition to these kinds of problems, where the relationships between communities, and particularly between communities and the government, is not being resolved in a satisfactory manner, we also have the problem of what we call collapsing states. States which, for a variety of reasons, seem to have all of the attributes of sovereignty in the legal sense, but had none of the attributes of sovereignty in the political sense. And they have literally collapsed and have taken the turn towards more primordial forms of governance, as you find in Somalia, where now it is clans and various criminal elements who basically run the country, although Somalia still has an ambassador in Ottawa and still has an ambassador in the United Nations. On the ground, it has ceased to exist. We have Kampuchea, which we tried to put back together. We don't know from day to day if it will succeed. Bosnia remains a problem that most people argue if the NATO troops withdraw from there, the whole thing will be rekindled. And as I suggested, the case of Russia remains a huge question mark. We still have many states where systematic persecution of minorities persists, as in Iraq, in Burundi, Iran, and other places. We still have kleptocrats of many varieties. Mr. Mobutu was replaced by somebody else in whom a lot of people had a great deal of faith, but it turns out that he may not be much better than his predecessor. And so in all of these kinds of situations, we can expect further armed conflict. And it's extremely difficult, once armed conflict begins in these places, to do anything very constructive about it. Because these are basically social wars rather than just wars between armies, it's very difficult to get the parties involved to the negotiating table. The sources of these wars are so much more complicated than just a piece of territory or a dream of an empire. And the solutions are very, very difficult to come by, and they're very difficult to make stick. The war in Sudan continues since 1983. And there's no sign that it is about to end. Cyprus remains divided since 1964. And despite many, many efforts, including one by Joe Clark, there's no indication that Cyprus is about to be reunified any more than it was 30 years ago. And as I suggest, the situation in Bosnia remains extremely problematical. Well, to conclude the question, can we do better? Well, we should do a lot better, and we can do a lot better, certainly in the case of interstate wars. The big problem is, what can the United Nations do, and what can individual countries do about this seemingly never-ending series of state catastrophes, collapses of kleptocracies, and all the rest? The United Nations has a fairly sophisticated early warning system. It has been able to identify societies which are on the verge of warfare. And Canadians have played a very prominent role in this. In fact, there are Canadian satellites which are designated to take photographs of troop movements and population movements. And we were able to play some kind of a constructive role in the case of Burundi several years ago. The problem then is not a technical one. The problem is a political one. The testimony of the Canadian general about the events in Rwanda in April 1994 quite clearly indicate that the United Nations and many governments had very clear the dimension of about 500,000 lives. In the case of ex-Yugoslavia, the United States initially, for domestic political reasons, washed its hands of the whole mess there and told the Europeans, "This is in your backyard, why don't you deal with it and we'll stay out of it." The Europeans failed that particular exercise quite badly. In fact, in some cases, particularly the instance of the German government, they made the situation worse. At the end of the Cold War, there seemed to be a kind of maybe 2 or 3 years of fairly great international exuberance about sending peacekeeping operations to these various trouble spots in the world, and in many cases the results were reasonably successful. But now I think we seem to be on the verge, or perhaps we are already in an era of what we might call donor fatigue, the concern about getting into a situation that seems like a bottomless pit with no solution in sight, without an exit strategy, of committing troops to operations which may last 10 years, 20 years, 30 years without any particular solution in sight. So it is a problem of political will rather than a technical will. And we have the means intellectually to know situations which are likely to bring forth these kinds of protracted social conflicts, but we haven't quite yet reached that point where there is a willingness on part of the international community to do anything constructive in time to save the situation. Thank you very much.
Would you please, because it's an interesting broad subject, keep the questions really clear and focused if you can? Thank you.
Why do these conflicts, why not? Can you, for so long, bring an end to hypocrisy?
Excuse me. The good question is, why do these conflicts continue for so long, when obviously very few people are gaining from them? Well, I try to emphasize that point, that when you get a conflict that lasts so long, various parties begin to develop a vested interest in the continuation of the conflict. We've seen this in Sierra Leone and Liberia and perhaps Somalia and other places. The dynamics of it are because that dividing line between criminality and war has become totally blurred now, that there are elements in there who profit from the war. A second reason is that we're talking now about where does a line between two states go and how do we redraft the boundary or something. We're talking about human relations. How do two or more communities coexist with each other, intermingle with each other? We're talking about neighborhoods of people, and which may or may not have conflicting ideologies, different identities, different religions, and all of these kinds of things. And we are talking about populations in some states which suffer from an intense feeling of insecurity, knowing that the main threat to their lives is not the neighbor next door necessarily, but is their own government. They don't trust the government. So until you get a sense of trust between the communities, but more importantly between the community and their state or their government, the possibilities of getting a treaty or a negotiation or resolution of the conflict are very slim indeed. The question was, to what extent is there a threat of American aggression in Iraq, and is what extent would this be a pattern of the 21st century? Well, the question is a little bit loaded, I suppose. I don't think Madeleine Albright would exactly agree with your use of terminology here, but I think it's nevertheless a very, very good question. I think here that the pattern which has emerged is that the United States seems to be quite unwilling, as a matter of policy, to apply military force against what seems to be a deliberate breach of the 1991 agreements without the approval or the support of most of the major powers. This is the big question now in front of the Security Council. The Americans claim that under the existing resolutions, they have the authority to use military force once they have determined that there has been a breach, not only of the 1991 agreements, but of the most recent agreement between Kofi Annan and Saddam Hussein. The other members of the Security Council argue, no, there is not an automatic right of response. It must be the Security Council which determines itself whether there can be a military response. I think the American position is partly conditioned by domestic politics. Great skepticism, and I know what you're talking about here. not that particular evidence, not that particular problem, but it's the problem of the Republican Party arguing that this agreement was a very poor one. And so they have to be very careful. But I don't think it's a case of American aggression. If military force is used, it is not for the conquest of Iraq. It is to try to force compliance with agreements that the Iraqis made in 1991 and more recently, just 2 weeks ago. How I see the future of terrorism. Well, this is not in my domain of expertise. There are many, many people who make a life of studying this. And I guess all I can say is that for those people who keep fairly careful statistics on these matters, such as the American State Department, that the incidence of terrorist activities or incidents seems to be declining over levels that were of about 5 or 10 years ago. And I don't think I really have the competence to say much beyond that.
Was Cyprus peaceful 2,000 years ago?
Well, Cyprus has been at war seemingly ever since Venus arose out of the sea there. So, but one might have thought that here was a kind of a test case of two communities, two quite distinct communities, which did manage to coexist for a long time, but then got totally sidetracked by Greek domestic politics. But the interesting thing from a point of view of international relations, we would think that a very simple solution to the Cyprus problem is to partition the island. It has a de facto functioning Turkish state on one side and a de facto functioning Greek Cypriot state on the other side. The international community is not willing to do that, because if it were to agree to the partition of Cyprus, they are afraid of sending that signal to every other secessionist group in the world, saying, oh-ha, if the United Nations sanctions the division of Cyprus, they will sanction the division of Sudan, they will sanction the division of Sri Lanka, of Burma, and of every other place where these conflicts are going on. So there is the matter of precedence here. But your point, I think, is well taken. These are areas of chronic conflict. All right, the two questions. One was the role of fossil fuels in future conflict, and the second was the role of demobilized Russian soldiers and others from the former communist countries of East Europe. The first question is, well, by definition, these protracted social conflicts do not live by fossil fuels. That is to say, they are fought generally at a more primitive level. They are fought neighborhood to neighborhood, town to town, road to road, where large machinery plays a very, very minor role. Those of us who are optimists and who are admirers of the Ballard Power Company in Vancouver could say perhaps fossil fuels will play a very small role within 50 years. We'll all have hydrogen cells instead. The second question is more important, and I think in line with this argument about the nature of these protracted social conflicts taking on characteristics which verge more on criminality, we have seen since the end of the Cold War a dramatic rise also in the number of mercenary soldiers, among whom are a great number of Russians, who are going around selling themselves to private security services, to governments, and to a variety of revolutionary groups, secessionist groups. They're active all over the world. Soldiers of fortune.
Yes, the question here.
What
Well, do you mind if I diverge just a little bit to tell you a story? The question was, what is the scorecard for the United Nations in the 20th century, and how do we see the United Nations in the 21st century? It was a story I learned about 2 weeks ago from a Ukrainian military official about Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein had a driver who bore an amazing physical resemblance to the famous physicist, a little bit like the man you see on the Chevron signs in Vancouver. And this driver was very devoted to Albert Einstein and was a bit of an amateur physicist himself. And so every time Albert Einstein had to give a speech, the driver always went. And he heard these speeches so many times that he almost learned them by rote. And so One day Albert Einstein wasn't feeling particularly well, and so he asked his driver if his driver would mind giving the speech for him that night. And the driver agreed to do so. And he gave the speech, just fluent, it was beautiful. And then the question period came, and he fielded a variety of questions until one like yours, a very difficult one, came to him. And he said, well, you know, that's actually a very simple question. I'm going to ask my driver to answer it for you. The short answer to your question is that the scorecard of the United Nations since the end of the Second World War has been highest in the area of decolonization. In a sense, the United Nations was the midwife of the delegitimization of colonialism and helped to prevent, in many instances, what might have been otherwise much more violent conflicts. In the area of intervention for peacekeeping activities, a vastly expanded role in the latter years of moderate success. And in the 21st century, because of the kinds of conflicts I've tried to outline tonight, the United Nations is going to become involved more and more. But I think it brings back the question the lady up here asked, that this is what has brought so much symbolic significance to the Iraq situation, because here's a case of the will of the Security Council against a recalcitrant member. And people are very much afraid that if the Security Council, in a sense, flinches in this one, it will set a precedent for others to take the path of Iraq and to try to challenge the United Nations. So it's still up in the air, but the record is getting stronger. Well, I'm not a demographer, and I guess I sort of dabble in population questions much as I dabble in fishing. It interests me a great deal, but I don't study as much as I might want to. There have been a number of studies which have tried to link population densities and population growth rates to the incidence of violence within societies and between societies, and they don't come up with a very firm answers one way or the other. We know that given certain levels of technological development, that societies can sustain very, very high population concentrations, as in Hong Kong and the west end of Vancouver. So we can adapt to these kinds of problems. The second is that the birth rates in many societies are moving dramatically downwards, so that the geometric growth of population that we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years is likely to slow down fairly significantly over the next two or three decades. And so presumably that our carrying capacity will be able to deal with these kinds of problems reasonably well. But it remains a problem in some areas in Central America, where it is tied to land ownership issues that do generate conflict, very, very intense types of conflict.
Final questions here, and then at the gentleman three rows up.
You've touched on this question almost a couple of times. Since the colonial powers defined many of these countries and we take them out pretty badly, why do we want to maintain them? Why not let them subdivide?
Well, this is a very good question. Since the colonial powers were in the first instance responsible for defining these countries, why do we hope to keep them together? This is basically an ideological question. We have two quite different principles in contradiction here. One is the principle of national self-determination, by which we are fairly sympathetic to people, particularly those facing threats from the state or other communities within the state, and that they have a legitimate reason, usually security, for having their own state. And we have to remember that in European history, the state initially was a security mechanism, both internal and external. On the other hand, we have the idea of the sovereign territorial state, which encompasses many societies, and Canada is a perfect example. And we'd like to think as liberals that we ought to be able to live together as two or more communities within a single state. Because once you start the process of dismantling states on the basis of ethnicity, language, or anything else, you get into the interminable questions of boundaries. Populations are no more stationary. You might have been able in the 18th century to draw lines and say, here's a population that lives here, and it's confined to that area. But now we're all intermixed almost everywhere in the world, except perhaps Iceland. And it's impossible to draw lines anymore. So there's only two permanent solutions to the question of communities who want to have, or which want to have, their own governments. You either redraw boundaries, in which case you're probably going to have violence, or you have ethnic cleansing. And neither is a very good long-term solution.
Final question, yes. Sorry, no, it was the gentleman next to you, actually. Has had quite a bit.
We always learned in our PhD programs never to say never, and I'll be the last one to suggest that the problem of nuclear weapons has been solved definitively. It has not. But it wasn't long ago when you and I and many other people in this room were worried about how we might escape Vancouver under certain circumstances. We don't worry about that very much anymore. Both the Americans and the Russians have taken steps to not to disarm their weapons, but in some cases to dismantle weapons, and whole classes of weapons have been dismantled and destroyed. The numbers have been reduced fairly dramatically, and they are no longer targeted against certain places as they used to be, though they can be retargeted very quickly. There has been a lot of talk about small nuclear weapons being ferried around and used by terrorists and so on. It's, so far, fortunately, it's been talk, but again, not being an expert on terrorism, I can't say what really the nature of that threat is. But I would say, compared to 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago, that we live in an infinitely safer world. And perhaps I might say that one of the reasons we don't get so worried about the Liberias of the world and the Sierra Leones of the world is because they do not represent a security threat to the rest of the world as the Cold War did. In a sense, we have the luxury of ignoring these horrible wars, knowing that even if they go on for 30 years, sure, many people are going to lose their lives, but it does not directly affect us, as it might have done 10 or 20 years ago.
I think we have to call a halt there, I'm afraid. Thank you, Professor Hansen. I wonder if I could ask Dr. Shirley Newman, Dean of Arts at UBC, to thank our speaker.
Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Holste is one of the most eminent political scientists internationally for his work in international relations, in the making of foreign policy, and as we've seen tonight, in the very closely related field of armed conflict and security. I think we've seen the basis tonight on which that eminent reputation is based, a talk very wide-ranging in its knowledge, powerful and acute in its analysis, and one that leads us with responsibilities, I think, as well as with information. Professor Holste is also one of the great teachers at UBC, and he's a great teacher because he knows a lot, because he can do what he has done for us tonight, can give us a lot of information, can present it in ways that are concise and coherent and very analytic, but also because he can lead us to a place where we have to take responsibility, and nothing more important, perhaps, than that in a university where we are educating citizens for, we hope, a peaceful world. Professor Holste has tonight identified in his cautious optimism about the 21st century, cautious because of what he calls protracted social conflicts. He has identified issues of governance as at the core of those protracted social conflicts, and he has identified internationally the question of political will. He has led us, I think, to the point where we have to take responsibility about governance and about political will if we are to avoid protracted social conflicts or do something about those, no matter how difficult it is to do something about those which exist. He has been once again a great scholar and a great teacher. Thank you, Professor Holste.